from the National Humanities Center. This is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Politics in 17th century England and the church and state in 15th century Florentine culture, this week on Soundings. First, a conversation with Thomas Cogswell of the University of Kentucky about parliamentary politics in early Stuart England. Following that, a discussion with David Peterson of the University of Texas at Austin about religion and culture in Renaissance Florence. Contemporary scholarship in English constitutional history reflects an ongoing debate among historians. Is history best expressed by examining large political events and figures, or by examining the more elusive details of everyday life in bygone times? Here is Thomas Cogswell.
In a way, you can see a beginning reaction in English history, again, getting back a decade ago, to the new historians, to the rather broad sweeping generalizations that tend to be very dismissive about the nitty-gritty of political history. Mm-hmm. And really, about a decade ago, there was a whole generation of historians, very influential and very talented, who would say, really, the most important things happen are the very specific tiny events. Whether things went one way or the other way, ultimately decide which way things went. And certainly, well up to the English Civil War, given a happenstance, someone living a little longer or someone dying a little earlier mm-hmm. could well have changed the course of events. And these historians have emphasized the very particular, very rigid view of history, one that has completely almost left out any notion of ideology, for example. People are not driven really by any lofty concerns. It's all really strictly the bottom line.
All right,
what's
now
in
that,
it for me?
That's your argument. That's the way you're approaching this topic, or is that...
No, what I'm trying to do is...
Yeah, let's set some contrasts here.
Okay. What I'm trying to do is, while I keep a very narrow focus, as indeed the people I've been talking about roughly might be called revisionist historians, while I'm certainly keep a very narrow approach, as they would, and while I certainly revel in obscure documents and very close reading of text, I also try and interpret work in history's broader strokes, shall we say. Certainly the role of ideology and how it's important. And also, the earlier historians have had a very incredibly narrow focus. Politics really was something that mattered to a group of three or four dozen people. It was decided at a card game at court about mm-hmm. what was going to happen. And while factions at court are very important, I also try and point out the there are other groups involved, both Parliament, some 400-odd members who can be very querulous in their own way, mm-hmm. and even beyond Parliament, there are a number of parliamentary constituencies, very broadly defined, and within quotation marks, you can talk about popular politics of the period. These things have largely been left out, and I'm trying to blend these all together in a more comprehensive account of what's going on in England before the Civil War.
How do you come to that, that sheds some fresh light on the topic?
Well, one of the things that certainly the revisionists would have pointed out with ample justice that was wrong with history that had been written before them, 19th and early 20th century, and even the history of the new historians, okay, the great sweeping interpretations of social historians, that they would have depicted, for example, the House of Commons as struggling for control, trying to take over power from the Crown.
And it wasn't?
Well, the revisionists would point out quite rightly that the gentlemen involved, the various MPs or Parliament men, as they were known at the time, were not actually attempting to struggle to take over the government. What they were trying to do, for example, was to institute very crudely what might be called good government. They wanted bang for their buck, or pop for their pound, if you want to put it in English parlance. They wanted to see that their taxpayers' money was spent reasonably well. And so what you would inevitably get is, instead of the older Whiggish account of Englishmen struggling to vindicate, in capital letters, liberty and freedom, and having some grand ideological agenda, what you can show instead is a group of people who are really reluctantly becoming revolutionaries, who are being almost forced willy-nilly to adopt increasingly radical events, men who really don't want to talk in grand constitutional terms, but again are being forced into it. Mm-hmm. They'd prefer to work well with the government, but when the government insists on doing things that they regard as brain damaged, it's very difficult for them to be moderate and deferential.
Well, let me challenge you a little bit, Tom Cogswell. If Parliament is so important,
How can you get it wrong? I mean, isn't it writ so large? Isn't it so obvious and apparent that the errors in interpretation are just obviously going to jump off the page and be glaring as historians do this stuff?
Well, the thing you have to appreciate is the way in which the parliamentary record was recorded. We certainly have a list of the bills that were passed, the acts of Parliament become statutes of the realm.
You mean the actual writing down of this stuff?
Well, the bills that actually come out of it.
Uh-huh.
But the debates that took place over the bills are recorded very sketchily. Formally, it was considered a very bad thing to take notes on the floor of the House. It's quite understandable. The king, for example, was well known for being upset with people who said things that he didn't agree with, particularly when they criticized his ministers or his own governmental policies.
So there's a lot of loopholes here.
Well, the problem is the parliamentary record is very laconic. Mm-hmm. What we have are, it's almost like Gary Cooper was sort of recording these things, yeps and nopes. And a number of the diaries, for example, they're really just jottings you took in a book, very quick notes you would take of things. Some of them have had very peculiar histories. One of the more extraordinary ones, for example, was briefly served what appears to have been a shingle for a while, or certainly insulation in a roof.
You're kidding.
It got wet. Uh-huh. We've only found it really in the 20th century, and it's extremely difficult to read. But really, you can say it's been a host of social historians that, at least for me as a political historian, have encouraged me to make an attempt, even though the end result is going to be terribly subjective and really is going to be a guess.
Mm-hmm.
But nonetheless, to make a guess about what's going on in the minds of a much more common subject of the king.
Mm-hmm.
And how he reacts to politics and the way in which his sort of political moods begin to change.
Name your numbers. What kind of evidence have you got in mind? What do you mean?
Well, let's take a very basic one. There really are no newspapers at the time, but there's certainly a lot of sermons. One of the classic things that we would, as early modern Englishmen, would have loved to do on Sundays would have been to gone to hear a good sermon.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, some of us might have gone to see two or three sermons. In the city of London, for example, we would have, almost as the same thing as going to the movies, would have gone to take in a number of sermons. Or if you were from the provinces and you came to London, it was like going to see the West End Theater now. You would want to rush out and, of course, pick up celebrated preachers. They would talk about theological points, but a lot of the better ones would also make not so glancing commentaries on contemporary events. Would
History.
Talk almost directly about what's going on now and what the appropriate response for a good Christian would be to these events.
All right, now this stuff falls into the bailiwick of popular history that has or has not been neglected.
Well, it's been dealt with largely, certainly the sermons have been dealt with very thoroughly by ecclesiastical historians, people interested in the history of the church. But for political historians, I think there's often a great deal that can be found in this because of the fact that these people are almost, well, in certain cases, almost like newscasters.
Huh.
They're making such a direct commentary on contemporary events that you can begin to sense, and given their influence, and some of these people, again, were celebrities in their own right. And they didn't achieve this because of the brilliance of their theological interpretation, but rather because of their willingness to talk for a broad audience about contemporary events. Another source, for example, that's been largely neglected, and perhaps with good reason, at least you can see why people have felt squeamish about using it, and that's because there would be things like political songs and ballads. Now we turn on the radio and listen to the top 40, and we snap our fingers to jazzy sort of love songs or I Want to Jump in Your Car and Drive Away at High Speed things. certainly we have romantic ballads like that that were very common in broadsides.
And these are important to a historian.
Well, they're important to a historian because they not only deal with sort of romantic topics or topics of social trends and changes going on there, but they also are important because they'll often become directly political.
Uh-huh.
They'll have be almost like political songbooks or impersonations of political events or Johnny Carson's monologue when he'll become directly political.
Rich Little.
Yeah, Rich Little when he starts doing his political impersonations. We really don't have political impersonations at the time, but we have songs about specific political events of the time. Most of them have tended to be neglected by historians and literary scholars, alas, because they are incredibly filthy. certainly our notion of what consisted of decency was not one that our ancestors in the early 17th century subscribed to. They had a much more liberal notion about what they could get away with.
Now, just parenthetically, Tom Cogswell, what you're talking here, you're telling me that a group of people that we know of as...
It's like Doug Clark doing politics.
Yeah, but now wait a second. You know, people who are, that we have come to understand as very conservative theologically, the Puritans, you're telling me that in their popular humor there was a references to, well, I don't want to put a lot of dirty words on the table, but the kinds of things that, as you say, would embarrass a modern audience.
Yeah, without question. Certainly, they had a sense that some of these things were considered a little indecent. Uh-huh. But a very common event, so it would appear, was flatulence. And you could certainly have a whole series of songs dealing with politics based around flatulence. One of the most common, really, tropes is a poem, What Happens When You Get 400 Guys Together in a Small Room, like the House of Commons, and one of them passes gas. And what happens in these documents is, first of all, they're kind of funny, right? As one of the punchlines went, I left the Commonwealth mine heir. What happens in that is...
Too bad Mel Brooks wasn't alive.
That's right. Not only are they sort of lamentable puns and sort of what we regard as ribald humor, but the brilliance of it for us, again, as political historians, is what will happen then with the group of people in the House of Commons dealing with political gas, shall we say, is the way in which the poem will go down through MPs one by one and devote a stanza or two to some of the MPs that we know about because they speak. But then they'll go down in an elaborate list of MPs that almost say nothing on the House of Commons, on the floor itself, in which we have almost no information on at all.
And therefore you have some insights into how they thought and the positions that they took.
Well, clearly not only that they thought, but rather that because the song is being widely dispersed among the audience, but rather things that, you know, we become aware that their constituents knew them for these particular reasons. Uh-huh. Now for us, they're almost ciphers. They mean nothing. They're names that show up. But again, by using some of these songs, for example, you can get a better handle on some of these people.
Let's wrap up our conversation, Tom Cogswell. Why is this stuff important? Let me challenge you. Does it make any difference to in our reading, in our contemporary reading of American history? Does it help us to understand our own politics any more wisely than we would without the kind of work that you do?
Well, one of the reasons why certainly my period has been written about so much is because it's one of the grand occasions in which an estate, an early modern medieval estate, actually managed to defend and to a certain extent expand its liberties and freedoms in a struggle against a government that could oftentimes become very autocratic, almost absolutist in nature. And this, of course, is quite stirring. For Englishmen, of course, there's an obvious interest. It would be the same is the origins of the American Civil War or the American Revolution. For Englishmen, what I'm really dealing with, what we've been talking about for the last half hour, is the origins of the English Civil War, why English society became badly polarized, why ultimately Parliament, or at least a majority of Parliament, is willing to challenge the king, and ultimately in 1649 cut his head off. These are major issues of critical importance, even 350 years later, for Englishmen. For Americans, by extension, it's also important about what happened in this grandly called the crisis of the Constitution in the early 17th century, because certainly the Founding Fathers were critically aware of what happened in England in this period, and they constantly refer back to it. Certainly they made great reference to these events during the American Revolution, and indeed it almost formed for them a model, a paradigm about how to act. Just as the English Parliament had defied what they regarded as the unjust demands of the English government, so too the American colonists were defying, in this case rather ironically, the will of the English Parliament in asserting their own, what they regard as their rights and freedoms.
Thomas Cogswell teaches at the University of Kentucky. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Thomas Cogswell worked on a study of parliamentary politics in early Stuart England. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings on European History continues. My guest now is David Peterson of the University of Texas at Austin. David Peterson is at work on a study of church-state relationships in 15th century Florentine culture. Here is David Peterson.
Conceptually, church and state are distinguishable. One can point to religious institutions and religious ideals, and one can point to, of course, political institutions and political ideals. They're separable in the way, I suppose, that mind and body are separable, which is to say, really, they're not. The relationship between church and state is much more symbiotic. When we think of the church and state, we're thinking of conflicts over concrete problems, such as the jurisdiction of courts, such as financial immunity for ecclesiastical institutions from taxation. But of course, really, church and state also work in complementary ways.
Yeah, there's a harmony there also. Am I right?
Well, church and state, in certain respects, support each other, or at least they did in 15th century Florence. The state, for example, offered material protection to the church. Mm-hmm. Florentine ecclesiastical institutions were, of course, as the Florentines were never shy of pointing out, protected by Florentine armies. Yeah. Religious in the city were protected from violence by Florentine police, sometimes by the Florentine courts. Florentines, the secular politicians, to look at the other side of the coin, often patronized, that is to say, provided funds, provided material support to religious institutions, because they realized that the religious institutions supported by the state can in turn give the state a certain credibility. Florence in the 15th century was not working to overcome or to destroy the power of the church. Rather, it was working to bring the church within the framework of the civic community. A few examples: processions. Mm-hmm. The government often put up the funds. It even created legislation in supporting major religious festivals, which had a civic character. The procession, for example, celebrating St. John the Baptist, who is the patron saint of Florence. The procession of Corpus Domini, Body of Christ, was supported by the state. Holidays were declared by the state. The commune often put up the money for many of the great projects, the great building projects, the Duomo of Florence, the cathedral, mm-hmm. was paid for with public funds. Many of the great works of art in Florentine churches were paid for not by the religious institutions but by secular patrons.
David Peterson, before our taping session, you told me that Florence represents, in one of its religious dimensions, it represents a looking back at the medieval church and an examination, not necessarily hostile, when we use the word critical, a critical examination of religion from the standpoint of the text, from the standpoint of an inherited religion that comes to us in words that have been written down. Talk to me for a few minutes about that and help me to understand why Florence is important to you as a historian as you look at Christianity in that context.
Yes, well, we were speaking of the Camaldoli monk, Ambrogio Traversari.
Not a household name, obviously, but one that's important to you as a historian.
Not a household name, but certainly a very famous figure of his own time. He was, as I said, a monk who was an abbot, who visited monasteries, who participated in the administration of the church, but he was also a scholar, mm-hmm. One of the earliest Greek scholars in Florence, who was engaged in looking back at early Christian texts, trying, in a sense, to understand, above all, the language of early Christian writers, applying the ideal that was characteristic more broadly of humanists, of trying to return to sources to establish correctly what the texts themselves were, and secondly, what the words had meant originally to their authors. So in that sense, Traversari represents in part the modernity. When, if we want to return to the issue of church-state and to the issue of conflict, by and large, these conflicts were not worked out in terms of a broad historical consciousness. By and large, they were often very specific conflicts tied to immediate events. if someone like Lorenzo Valla used the humanist tools in broad historical terms to criticize the origins of the papacy, Florentines, for example, when they were arguing for a new clerical tax, were less inclined to go back and scour the canon law and to scour the old church texts than to accept the laws as they stood, and to point more to contemporary examples. They were less likely to say 200 years ago X was the case, and more likely to say, look, right next door, Venice is getting this kind of deal. Why can't we have it too? Florentine ambassador, when the Florentines wanted, for example, let's stay with the issue of taxation. When the Florentines wanted to impose a tax on the clergy, they would point to generalities, the fact that Florence was building the cathedral for the clergy, the fact that Florence was defending its territory in which clergy also lived. And they would usually go to the Pope saying, look, we have a set of concrete problems before us. We're at war again with Milan or with Lucca. Our citizens have paid all the taxes they can possibly bear. And the Venetians just got a tax. I mean, you just gave the Venetians permission to level a tax of X number of ducats on their clerics.
It sounds very much like the sort of thing that we'd read about in the New York Times or the Washington Post. The emphasis more, particularly on religion and the religious atmosphere, but the same sort of healthy debate and discussion going on.
Well, debate and discussion. The Florentines were above all pragmatists. I mean, this is if one wants a signature for Florentine culture, we associate it with lofty ideals, but that great culture was produced by very pragmatic means, and so also in handling church-state relations. One doesn't get great orations, one gets compromises, deals.
David, help me to understand why Florence, again, you're a historian looking at 15th century Florentine culture. Why is it important, for example, as we look at American politics and government? You again, before our taping, you used the word Republican models. You look at it as a historian. Of what general interest might it be to people who are listening to this discussion?
I think it's an important reminder of why church and state should, as much as possible, be kept separate. Florentine state, for example, relied on religious institutions. It's natural for us to want to dress our specific political agendae within grander frameworks. Yeah. It's natural for us to want to assert that what we do in our own legislation is somehow that which God wants us to do. And yet we make a bed for ourselves which is difficult to sleep in. To give a few concrete examples, I mentioned to you that the Florentine government patronized the church. That the Florentine government, for example, passed laws on women's dress as a means of bringing to bear Christian ideals of modesty, if not chastity, and this was presented as being part of what a government does in a godly community. And they supported the church in this way. On the other hand, this, of course, was to acknowledge the fact that the church, as another institution in the community, had a credibility of its own. Thus, for example, in 1458, when the Medici party was making a push to arrogate to itself more political authority in the community, they had suspended balloting in the communal councils. They had suspended the right of members of the Florentine legislatures to vote secretly for measures. It was the Archbishop of Florence who intervened and said, I'm sorry, you simply cannot do this. And he got away with it. He blocked the Medici because he had a power in the community, which, you know, as the community tried to arrogate to itself the power that he disposed of, it also acknowledged the fact that he had the power to check and control them. It's a lesson in the fact that it's very appealing to try to manipulate religious ideals for political ends, but that game can backfire on you.
What do we have to learn from these 15th century Florentines, David? Why are you passionate about them in your scholarship? Why do you want to take them to not only a group of specialists, but to a general audience as well?
I suppose for a couple of reasons. First of all, intellectually, I admire the sophisticated approach to religion that someone like Traversari embraces, someone who realizes that on the one hand, religion can be very simple. It's a matter of personal morality. It's a matter of setting standards of conduct for yourself. but someone who also realized that approached intellectually or dogmatically, religion soon becomes very complex, and one has to respect that complexity.
Hmm.
Politically, I suppose, I look to Florence as a reminder that although the separation of church and state is an important ideal, it's an ideal which is not nearly so simple to maintain as we think. It's a perilous ideal to neglect. The relations between church and state in 15th century Florence were torturous precisely because religious and communal Florentine institutions were so closely interwoven. Their coy efforts to interweave, the coy efforts at clergy, for example, to profit from their lay patrons, the coy efforts of the commune to exploit religious ideals or to exploit religious institutions led them into a series of contradictions from which it was difficult for them to exit. I tend in my own work to emphasize the interrelationship of church and state, precisely to demonstrate the problems that that presents. And looking at modern culture, for example, that leads me to want to shy away from those who try to conflate religion and politics. We have an instinct to do that. All human beings have an instinct to want to dress their ideals within broad precepts. It's dangerous. It's dangerous, above all.
David Peterson teaches at the University of Texas at Austin. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, David Peterson worked on a study of Renaissance Florentine culture. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings is available on cassette. Send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Ask for program number 431. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, conversations about political ideology in 19th and 20th century Europe and America. My guests will be Charles Kessler of Claremont McKenna College and James Booth of Duke University. Here's news of interest to high school teachers. In June and July of 1989, the National Humanities Center will sponsor seminars on two topics, literature and its audiences, and the concept of republicanism. These enrichment programs are for high school teachers of literature and history. For an application, write to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. The deadline for applications is March 1st, 1989. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. The first week in January marks an anniversary for the Emancipation Proclamation issued by President Abraham Lincoln in January 1863. E.M. Forster, the English author of A Passage to India, was born in early January 1879. Betsy Ross, reputed to be the creator of the first Stars and Stripes American flag, was born in Philadelphia during the first week in January 1752. And Ulrich Zwingli, the Swiss social reformer, was born in early January 1484. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Parliamentary politics in 17th century England and church-state relations in Renaissance Florentine culture. Two discussions this week on Soundings. Listen for Thomas Cogswell of the University of Kentucky and David Peterson of the University of Texas at Austin. The Politics of Early Stuart England and the Religious Culture of 15th Century Florence. Some answers and insights this week on Soundings.